Support for KQED Podcasts comes from Star One Credit Union, now offering real-time money movement with Instant Pay. Make transfers and payments instantly between financial institutions. Online or through Star One's mobile app. Star One Credit Union, in your best interest.
From KQED.
Hey there, everyone. From KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos.
And I'm Scott Schaefer. And today on The Breakdown, we're excited to have with us a guy who's known for his innovative campaign strategies and, shall we say, brash approach to politics. Somebody who is not afraid to play the role of outsider, Marisa.
That's right. Joe Trippi is joining us today. He is a legend in Democratic politics and now host of a new podcast, That Trippi Show. Get it? It aims to give Democrats a roadmap to defeating President Trump in November. And we're going to talk with this veteran campaign manager in a few minutes. But first, Scott, where to start? Let's start with the fun stuff.
Next week,
we're finally going to have Joe Biden name his VP choice, allegedly.
You mean we can't, speculate for another month?
I know. The Veep Sticks is finally going to end. We do know that we think two Californians are on that list, right? Karen Bass, Kamala Harris. There's been, and we'll definitely want to have Joe weigh in on this in a little bit. But I don't know. You want to bet? You want to make any predictions at this
point? I feel, who knows, right? It's going to be Biden's gut. I think these people, if he's talking to them as the finalist, they've all made it through the process. So it's going to come down, I think, to his gut, who he's comfortable with. And, I feel that it's down to two people. It's down to Kamala Harris and Susan Rice, who he knows so well. Others will disagree, including perhaps Joe. but I feel like, Harris, she has always been sort of in the post position, the one to beat, top of the list. She checks all the boxes. She's got the Senate credentials, the statewide California credentials, vetted nationally, been on the stage, been on the debate stage. So, if you're looking for somebody who is maybe low risk and not going to screw things up, I'd say, Kamala Harris.
So, if it's Susan Rice, Scott gets a lot of credit because he's been raising her name before that was even in the headlines.
I want Guy Maserati in with us because he was the one that just rolled his eyes.
But I will say, I think you can tell that Harris is probably among those top contenders because of how much trash talking has come out from other parts of the Biden universe who clearly don't want her to be the vice presidential nominee. And I think that gives us a little sense. But I mean, it is really fascinating. I wouldn't have expected necessarily that we would have Californians on that list at all, perhaps.
Two of them. Let alone
maybe
two,
three.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, Karen Bass, we had her on the show last week. And, she's really come out of nowhere, really. I'm quite sure that 2 months ago, Karen Bass never occurred to her that she might be vice president of the United States.
Yeah, right. Or any of us. Well, we will have to all wait like everybody else. Quickly, Scott, we are having a lot of talk in California this week around unemployment benefits, obviously a national conversation as well. As we tape this on Thursday, there is a hearing going on in Sacramento about our employment development department's just inability to get money into the hands of people that need them. I think tens of thousands of claims that have not been fulfilled. And Newsom promising to do more here. We're all waiting to see what Congress will do. I mean, what's your bet for folks who are, relying on this money that expires this Friday? What do you think is going to happen?
Well, there's going to, as always, there's going to have to be some kind of compromise. I mean, I think the big sticking point is going to be that $600 bonus that was in the federal package the first time. Republicans are really not happy about that. I think they're going to have to negotiate that down maybe to, $300, something like that, in order to get enough Republicans or Mitch McConnell in particular and Trump to support it. I mean, there's too much financial pressure on Americans in the middle of this pandemic to just sort of let it drag on and on and on, because people have to pay rent, they have to pay all kinds of bills. And I think that I think something will happen. They're talking in Sacramento about doing it themselves with state money, which is a little thinly explained, I would say. There were no details.
Well, I mean, the idea is, there are details. What they're saying is that they're going to borrow against the federal unemployment fund, which is what we did during the Great Recession 10 years ago, and just paid that money back by raising taxes on businesses. So I do think, there clearly is money there. I understand that there would be a desire to really bridge this gap, because to your point, I think economists generally agree that this downturn would be way worse since March if people didn't have that cash in their pockets. And we are seeing a lot of debates now happening, too, around eviction protections and whether those should be extended at the federal and state level. But I think to your point, the state budget is in terrible disarray. They are asking for money from the federal government. Republicans are not willing to go there yet. And if they don't get it, we're going to see deeper cuts this
yeah,
fall.
Yeah, there's like, I think, $14 billion in trigger cuts if that federal money doesn't come through. And, you know, as you said, the EDD, the Department of Employment Development, is a mess. They have given out, in their defense, about $49 billion in benefits since March. But, you know, as you said, about a million people's claims kind of sitting there waiting for more information. It's an arcane system, an antiquated technology. I'm sure it's frustrating to Governor Newsom, who is a techie at heart, right, in some ways a geek. And, you know, I think that, you know, that is the way government has been allowed to operate for so long in California and elsewhere.
Yeah, I will say one last thing is that, you know, Newsom came in with similar complaints about the DMV. I don't think he has solved them, but I think we have seen an improvement in a lot of what's happened there. So I know we all roll our eyes when they create a strike team, but maybe we'll get somewhere with this.
Yeah, maybe this one will actually strike.
All right, we're going to take a break in a minute, but before we do, I do want to acknowledge this morning we saw three former presidents eulogize Congressman John Lewis, who, of course, died recently, a lion of the civil rights movement, an amazing man, and President Obama gave the official eulogy, and I think you saw, at least watching from my house on Twitter, just a lot of people really happy to hear from all of our former presidents, including George W. Bush, obviously a Republican, and just a lot of tears being shed across America right now.
Yeah, and I think there's clearly a message that, you know, John Lewis really organized this service to a large degree. I think he wanted to have a Republican speaking. He, you know, President Bush did sign an extension of the Voting Rights Act. And, of course, the elephant in the room is who wasn't there, which is the current president. And Nancy Pelosi also, you know, gave a wonderful tribute to John Lewis, got very choked up. You know, it's rare that you have somebody who comes to Congress as a hero of sorts. Mm-hmm. You know, I think of John Glenn, perhaps, and John Lewis certainly was on that list.
Yeah. All right. We are going to take a short break now. When we come back, we're going to be talking with veteran campaign manager turned pundit Joe Trippi. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. Some want it all. SFO wants zero. Zero landfill waste, net carbon, and net energy by 2030. Learn more about the triple zero goal at flysfo.com.
I'm Jonathan Hill, host of The Weeds. And I know that politics can feel like a joke, and not always in the ha-ha funny way. On The Weeds, we try to split the difference.
When you think run out of money, you think we're going to get to a point where, like, one guy retires and Social Security is like, sorry, y'all, got to board up.
Like, that's it. Sorry, he got the last check.
I always call him Jim. Like, Jim got it. Sorry, y'all. He got the last check, and that's all the checks we got, and Social Security is no more.
Check out The Weeds every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts.
And welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos here with Scott Schaefer, and we are thrilled to welcome Joe Trippi. He is the host of a new podcast, That Trippi Show, and he's run numerous political campaigns, including Howard Dean's 2004 presidential bid and Alabama Senator Doug Jones' successful defeat of Roy Moore in 2017. Joe Trippi, welcome to The Breakdown.
Good to be with you.
Thank you for coming, and we want to talk about some of these campaigns and what you're looking at for this November. But we thought it'd be fun first to go back a little bit to your biography and talk about how you ended up in politics. We know you were born, I think, in Jamestown, New York, and you moved across country when you were a couple years old. But it's your dad owned a flower shop there, right?
Yeah, we moved to California when I was three months old, excuse me, and he ended up owning starting Spartan Shops in San Jose, California. He had the family had a flower shop in Jamestown. The grandfather brought that. That was sort of the trade he brought with him from Italy, and my father followed in his footsteps and started a flower shop in San Jose.
We should say not just Italy, but Sicily. Right? Yeah. You're Sicilian.
Exactly.
So how did that play out in the family?
Not well, because my dad wanted me to take over the flower shop, and
made you an offer you couldn't refuse, but you did.
No, I wanted to. I was actually just started to catch the political bug, and so came east to get involved in my first presidential campaign and several others. And we didn't actually, being Sicilian, he didn't talk to me for a number of years because he thought I was had escaped the family tradition and traded it in for the evil, horrible, corrupt game of politics.
Well, how did that come to be? I mean, I know you started getting political when you were at San Jose State here in our backyard in the Bay Area. I mean, was politics something you guys ever talked about at home?
No, not really. I would drive flower deliveries a bit, but mostly I was an aeronautical engineering major at San Jose State, which again, sort of him being an old-time Italian, he kind of viewed college as an excuse for skipping work. You must go to college, family. That wasn't the kind of the place I grew up in anyway.
I have to ask you about one of the jobs, or maybe the only job you had while you were in college. You were a repair person for pinball machines on campus, I guess in the student union. How'd you get into that?
There was a bowling alley in the student union. It had pinball machines. They kept breaking down, and they actually put up a help wanted sign there saying, and I had no idea what I was doing, by the way, but it was, cool. I was sort of into engineering and stuff anyway. So I understood, circuits and things like that. And so, I basically spent a couple of years in college being a pinball wizard of sorts, which was a blast. In terms of having a job where you, oh, geez, I've got to test that machine one more time, make sure it's working.
Well, you mentioned that you went, you drove cross country, I think, in a Ford Pinto to your first presidential campaign in Iowa. But before that, you, I think, helped run a mayoral or city council race. You got involved in anti-apartheid stuff at the university, affirmative action. Was there a moment where you just went, oh, my God, this is it? Politics is it, even the local stuff?
No, it kind of happened. The first thing I ever remember in politics was I was excited by Bobby Kennedy in 1968. But it was fleeting. 68 happened. He was assassinated. I felt horrible about it. I was only, I think, 12 years old then. But later, I think that was the spark that in San Jose, while I was a aeronautical engineering major, I started fighting apartheid, South Africa. I organized a little bit at student organization for Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers on the Great Boycotts and things like that. Just there were small like weekend things, like this weekend I'll go help do that. And I just kept getting more and more involved on the political side. I remember distinctly in college one day, at San Jose State, wondering what was going to change people's lives more, this technology that was pervasive throughout the valley and starting, really moving, or politics, somebody like Bobby Kennedy, who would change people's lives more. And I, having picked politics, I can tell you that I think the cell phone probably changed more people's lives than any of the politicians I can think of, although many of them have done great, incredible things. Well, John Lewis being a great example of that.
Yeah, and in some ways, you were able to merge technology coming out of San Jose State, Silicon Valley, and politics, because that was really, and we're jumping ahead a little bit here to the Howard Dean campaign in 2004, but you were really a pioneer in using the internet, something that's very common now, to raise money and other things. How did that come to be?
Well, I had gosh, by 1988, I had been involved in three or four different presidential campaigns, from Vice President Mondale to Gary Hart. I mean, and by the end of the 80, and Gephardt, and by the end of 88.
And Jerry Brown.
You know, that would be 92.
Yeah, that was a little later.
That's true. That's true. Later.
But at that point, I had really, and by 92, I had really gotten sick of politics. I mean, I had just sworn off that I would never work after Jerry's campaign, that I would never work in another presidential campaign.
What was it about that campaign that turned you off?
No, it was a great campaign.
It was 88,
right? I tell everybody the same thing. I would tell every American, you must go to work in a presidential campaign. Do one in your lifetime. It'll be the greatest experience you ever had in your life, and you'll remember it forever. But the very next second after you say that to yourself, when it ends, the very next breath is, please God, don't let me ever do that again. By 92, it had nothing to do. Jerry was, I loved working for Jerry in not just that campaign, his races for attorney general, his races for governor against Meg Whitman. But I got, that would happen later, but I went through this period in the 90s where I really had kind of sworn off that kind of involvement in politics, and had gotten more involved back in technology in Silicon Valley and e-commerce and cybersecurity, of all things, back then, and had learned enough, I guess, by the time I got the call from Howard Dean, I was dangerous enough. I knew enough about politics to be dangerous with understanding the technology that was out there. There were a lot of politicians that didn't understand technology at all, a lot of people in technology that didn't understand politics, and I had sort of unwittingly waded my way through both worlds. And when Howard Dean called, it was, I was still had that, no, I do never want to do this again, but I'll do it if you let me do it differently. Was sort of that was the draw. That, I mean, one, he was against the war, I was against, there's lots of policy reasons that he was attractive to me, but the biggest was, in the end, the tiebreaker, the thing that actually made me decide to do it, was that he was courageous enough to say, yeah, you know, let's do it different than it's ever been done. Maybe we're 4 years ahead of our time. The iPhone wasn't launched until 2007. YouTube didn't exist. Facebook was on two college campuses in 2004. Twitter didn't exist. So the tools and the ability to directly build something the way Bernie Sanders, Barack Obama, other people were able to do later, it started there. We pioneered a lot of it, but it just didn't play out the way.
You were ahead of your time. You know,
spoiler alert, yeah. Howard Dean did not win that. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Political Breakdown on KQED Public Radio. I'm Marisa Lagos here with Scott Schaefer. We are talking to veteran Democratic campaign manager Joe Trippi. I mean, the other thing, reading back over that time that you talk about is, you know, politicians that have it. That thing, that je ne sais quoi, whatever it is, we've seen more recently people like AOC, I think. Saw Bill Clinton talking today. I think he had it in his own way. How do you choose that? Like, what is it about someone like Dean that spoke to you, Jerry Brown? Like, these are all very different people.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I've been successful enough, or whatever you want to call it, that I genuinely have been able to work for people I wanted to work for, not because I had to, I had to get on another campaign just to figure out how to make it through the cycle and pay the rent. And so I've been lucky that way. But the thing I learned a long time ago is I'm not trying to elect Joe Trippi's candidate in California or in Alabama. I'm trying to elect somebody who is there representing California, representing that district in Oklahoma. And so you've got to learn, or I tried to learn that, I may be, really progressive on this issue or that issue, but that's not my, if I'm somewhere else, it's about making sure I help that candidate find that voice that reaches the people he or she are trying to represent. And so that's why I think I worked for so many different people. And usually the big attraction for me has been it can't be done. I think that was part of what made me want to do the Dean campaign, see if you could do a campaign that sort of cut through around everything and went directly to voters. I'd been always frustrated by been a TV consultant, and I was always frustrated that it was a one-way medium. In fact, in 92 with Jerry Brown, me and a colleague named Joe Costello, who I still work with from time to time, came up with the 800 number idea for Jerry, that raised all that, trying to turn TV into a two-way thing where, you'd hear him and he'd say, call my number, and, and people contributed to him.
That was the early version of internet donations, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, that we raised $8 million for Jerry in that campaign for president in 92. And so that's why, I mean, there's a long history of me trying, where I'd been trying to wrestle with that. I think that was part of the Dean thing. I think, Doug Jones, I think, look, he's literally one of the most decent people I've ever met in the 40 years I've been involved in politics. And I think, when I sat down with him the first time, and no one had won in Alabama statewide, no Democrat for 25 years.
Other than having your opponent be Roy Moore, what did you learn about, winning in a place like Alabama, or was that just really a one-off?
No, the fact of the matter is everybody's got the whatever people have in their heads about what happened in that campaign. It still astonishes me about how everybody didn't get what really happened and how different it was. We had come from something like 18 points down to Roy Moore to being within 1 point of him. Our poll came out, we were at 40, he was at 47, we were at 46. And that was all on Doug Jones talking about coming together and finding common ground. A very powerful ad that where he talked directly to camera really moved the race. And then it was after that, it was several days after that, that the Washington Post story came out and said, Roy Moore is dead, there's all these allegations. And the actual thing that happened was a lot of the Republicans that we had won over with our common ground, that Doug Jones had won over with the common ground message, all went into, oh my gosh, it's the Washington Post, the elites, they're attacking our guy, and they started to go home. Actually, Roy Moore actually gained ground and went ahead of us off that story. Not that he's dead, you guys haven't won. I mean, it's like almost the reverse of what actually, we spent the rest of the campaign always trying to win back those common ground Republicans, enough of them to win the seat, which is what we were able to do. If anything, what I've seen in 2018 and now in 2020, there are more of those. I mean, there are more, they were suburban women, GOP women, younger Republicans, college educated, so some I may call business Republicans, but they're looking more and more towards Joe Biden, and I'm not talking about Alabama now, I think
more broadly,
across the country, more broadly. What we saw in 2017, little glimmers of it, and enough of it to get us across past Roy Moore by 23,000 votes.
Well, can I ask you about
across the country? Yeah. I think.
Well, can I ask you about that? I know you talked about this on your first episode of your podcast, which is, you know, the John Kasich, former Ohio governor, is rumored to be talking, or maybe is for sure, at the Democratic convention this year. And a lot of progressives were really turned off by that. Talk about, like, how Democrats need to, why Democrats would want someone like him, and what you think they need to do to get some of those folks that, you know, propelled Doug Jones to victory.
Well, look, I mean, as I've said, you know, politics, the other lesson is politics is about addition, not subtraction. I think Donald Trump has spent every day of his presidency subtracting away from where he could have gone. I think the people were willing to give him the benefit of the doubt in the beginning, some. And he squandered that, and then it started subtracting ever since. I think Kasich is an example of those Republicans I'm talking about that are looking now across the aisle at Joe Biden and sort of where the party is, where their own party is, and saying, is it safe to go there? And I think for Democrats, we want to be the big tent party that invites them in. I'd much rather be having a debate with Kasich about where you could actually sit down, negotiate, have actual amendments on the floor that get voted one way or the other, and argue with Kasich, than to have to continue sort of this polarized, no one works together. That we need to invite them over, not push them away.
Well,
and that's one of the lessons I've learned, coming out of Alabama.
Well, in light of all that and everything else that you've learned along the way, we got to ask you about Biden's pick. Who do you think he should pick, and who do you think he will pick if they're different?
Well, I've said that if it were me, I'd pick Mayor Bottoms. Keisha Lance Bottoms in Atlanta. He's not going to do that.
You just dismiss that right out of hand.
That's not going to happen.
But that's you, right? You're a little out of sync sometimes with the conventional wisdom.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I'm not I'm not an insider in my party. I think most of them would say, if you could go back and look at the Dean and Jerry Brown and other things, you know, at the national level, that I'm sort of considered an outsider. But my reason is I think if you look at COVID, if you look at the police reform, racial tension, getting these small businesses, how do we open? Open and schools. How do we reopen schools locally? I can make the case for picking somebody at the local level and say, I want that. I want a partner to help.
Yeah,
me.
We're really short on time. Sorry to interrupt. But so, who do you think he will pick, real quick?
I think Kamala Harris has a really good chance of being picked. I think the thing that makes her stand out for me above the rest of them. Is that she was tested, assuming the vetting and all that, she's been through the fire of a presidential campaign. She knows what that is like. And what you don't know really about any of the others, including Rice, is how will they stand up to that? They can vet, they can pass all the vetting, but you put them in front of those cameras, that is a different thing.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Joe Trippi, thank you so much. I think your next podcast episode drops on Friday, so check it out. That's going to do it for this edition of Political Breakdown. We are a production of KQED Public Radio.
Our producer is Guy Marzorati. Our engineer is Jim Bennett. Today, KQED's team includes Holly Kernan, Ethan Lindsay, Vinny Tong, Erica Aguilar, and Jonathan Blakely. I'm Scott Schaefer. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm @ScottSchaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. You can find me on Twitter @MLagos. Thanks for listening.